So we have been here together practicing now for a little over one day. And we might find ourselves wondering, reflecting what we're doing, reflecting on why we're doing what we're doing. Perhaps a question has occurred to you in the course of the practice. And I'd like to just speak a little bit about some of what I see as the framework or kind of underlying kind of reality in which we undertake such a practice as this, in which we engage in such a retreat as this. Can I just check, can you hear all right at the back? I heard someone said that apparently some couldn't hear yesterday. Please, if you can't hear, get my attention and I will endeavor to not swallow this thing but get a little closer to it. So all this technology around, I'm using the computer because I actually can't read my notes anymore without glasses, and if I put glasses on, I can't see you, so it's the story of life. It goes in this direction, it seems. But here we are. Here we are on this retreat. Here we are in our life. And perhaps it's a useful place to begin contemplating what we're doing. This circumstance, we find ourselves here, we could say, between birth and death, alive, born without being asked to. And for pretty much everyone, not always, but almost everybody, we die at a time we don't choose, in a way we don't control. But we're here for a time in between those two events. At least we choose to come on retreat, so it feels like, you know, we're sort of a little bit making it happen. But we don't necessarily choose what happens when we come on retreat. You might have noticed this. We might perhaps have chosen slightly differently a few of the things. Or maybe not. Maybe we would have chosen it just like this. But part of what happens here, we come into a retreat, we give ourselves to a spiritual practice, to a form of engaging that's oriented in a way that's different from perhaps much of our ordinary activity. We give ourselves to a certain discipline, a certain commitment, an undertaking which involves not just following our habitual patterns or our sort of urges and reactions, but establishing ourselves in a relationship to what's going on that is intended to and has the potential to offer something quite remarkable, profound, and transforming. And what begins to happen as we do this practice, sitting, walking, standing, being in contact with our experience, is we start to feel it a little more deeply, a little more keenly, a little more vividly, we could say. So life starts to stand out to us. Experience starts to stand out to us. It's not always that we regard this as good news. Sometimes it's like, I'm not sure I want to feel it quite that fully or clearly or strongly. We might have some idea about coming on retreat and this idea of, it will be lovely, it will be peaceful, calm, and my heart will be at ease, my mind will become quiet, my body will feel sort of warm feelings of bliss and joy, and these rather nice fairy stories we might tell ourselves, even if we know it's not likely, we kind of, okay, it's not quite like that, is it? I don't know if it's like that for you, it's not like that for me, and it's not mostly what I hear people report. So there's the sense of being asked to turn towards what's here, to see that things aren't always the way we wish them to be. Now, this is sort of obvious for us, isn't it? We know that. I don't think anyone's going to be surprised if I say, or anyone else would say, things aren't always the way we want them to be. And yet, there's a way in which we, I think, easily imagine, believe, or just hold on to some kind of hope that if I just worked it out how to do it, then I could get them to be just the way I want them to be. I could. And maybe spiritual practice, maybe meditation is the thing that's going to do that for me. But what we come along and we discover is that we encounter at times pain or dullness, restlessness, boredom, anxiety, fear, loneliness, maybe grief, anger, confusion. It's like, oh, just a moment. I'm not sure that's what I came here for. Did anyone have that thought? That what's happening for me is, I'm not sure that's what I came here for. And yet, whether we know it or not, that is what we came here for. We come into a situation like this to see our life more clearly, more fully, more deeply, and to begin to understand what is true about it. It's not to say that that which is difficult or challenging is the totality. Of course, there are many things which are beautiful, which are sweet, which are lovely, which are delightful and gladdening of the heart. And these too we may encounter, we may notice here in our being together on the retreat, and just the lovely food that is offered and the enjoyment of taking some just, you know, bread and trina. And if you've been away from Israel for some years, as I have, to have some trina again is like, oh, how lovely. And then, of course, it's like, but it's kind of hot, and I lose my appetite when it's hot, so I can't eat as much bread and trina as I want to. And these little things occur for us. But there's a very deeply rooted and underlying idea that most of us have at some level, somewhere in our minds, our hearts, our consciousness. And it gives rise to a kind of a false hope that things might somehow turn out to be fundamentally different than they are. It's this idea that somehow peace, satisfaction, fulfillment, the fruition of our lives is to be found somewhere else, is to be found in some other experience, in some other place, or in becoming some other thing than we are. And there's a way in which we can be looking, always reaching, always moving, always leaning towards something else, looking for something else. And the primary way this shows itself, I don't know if you recognize this at all, that sense of looking for something else, hoping for something to be just a little different, or maybe quite a lot different than it is. Even just here in the retreat with so many good things, maybe you've already noticed a few ways it could be improved. Yeah? If you have a few ideas about the schedule or about the organization or about the cushions or... Yeah, I imagine you have a few ideas like this. Maybe. And this basic mechanism that we employ, that we engage in to sort of, we imagine, get us to that place or bring us to those conditions which will provide us fulfillment, satisfaction, peace, relief, rest, ease, whatever it is that we're looking for, that mechanism, if we're not very conscious and aware of what moves us, it's this mechanism inside that seeks constantly for comfort and security. It seeks constantly to avoid the uncomfortable or the scary and to have only contact with that which is comfortable, enjoyable, pleasurable, and that which gives us some sense of reassurance that doesn't threaten us or challenge us in any way. To seek to avoid pain and get pleasure. In a simple way, we could see. To avoid fear and try and create security. And this process brings us into conflict with experiences that maybe at times are uncomfortable for us, or maybe do sometimes scare us in different ways. And the urge, the need to control, to manipulate, to organize both what's going on around us and equally what's going on within us. This arises and can be very strong. And we find ourselves so easily in conflict with our life. Now, the result of this conflict, this process, is I think very well illustrated by a story of something that took place off the coast of Canada some years ago. And I'd like to read you the story of what took place. It was reported by the Canadian authorities. And if I move away a little bit, does it mean you don't hear me? I'm just needing to check at the back. Can you hear me if I do this? Less, but you, okay, still can. Okay. So you might just imagine this conversation. It actually took place. It's reported as such by the Canadian Chief of Naval Operations. And it involves a communication from an American ship coming to the Canadians saying, please divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. And the Canadians respond. They say, we recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. The Americans respond, this is the captain of a U.S. Navy ship. I say again, divert your course. You feel it's getting a little worked up here. The Canadian's response, no. I say again, you divert your course. And this next bit's in capital letters, so I think it equates to shouting. It's from the American ship. It says, this is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the United States Atlantic Fleet. We are accompanied by 3 destroyers, 3 cruisers, and numerous support vessels. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north. That's 15 degrees north. Or countermeasures will be undertaken to ensure the safety of this ship. The Canadians respond, this is a lighthouse, Migdalor. Your call. We have this, I think, it's kind of funny to always, apologies, I have some dear friends who are American, I very close to them, but it's somehow enjoyable to laugh at the great powers seeming to be foolish in their power. And perhaps also we can recognize ourselves in a certain way in what happens when things that we wish to be different or not in our way, we want them to get out of our way. So often we want life to be different than it is. But life cannot be different than it is any more than the lighthouse, the Migdalor, can move away from the ship. It must be the ship that makes the adjustment or else there will be a collision. And we know who will come off second best in this case. So this process of seeing how we come into contact, and often in coming to contact with life, how we find ourselves in contention, in conflict. How contact becomes conflict. We fight, we struggle, we don't want this to be the way it is. And we must contemplate and reflect upon the fundamental aspect of human experience. Much of this is not in our control. We can't get our body to sit comfortably for 45 minutes. I mean, maybe some of us can some of the time. But most of the time we can't. Most of the time, even if it's comfortable, I mean, if it's comfortable, it starts falling asleep. Have you noticed that? You know, it hurts, it hurts, it hurts. Oh, finally it stopped hurting. And then, wow, it's really hard to stay awake. You know, one thing after another, it seems sometimes. The temperature. You know, they said it was going to get cooler. Maybe this is cooler, but it's still kind of hot. You know, and of course, in England, I was there just a few days ago where I live, mostly everybody wants it to get hotter because it's too cold. You know, wherever you are, it seems it's never quite what we wish, never quite what we hoped for. Our neighbors, the schedule, our mind. Do we notice this process whereby we keep looking at, We keep encountering experience, and there's the sense of, okay, I just need to fix it. If I can just tell my neighbors to be a bit quieter, you know, if they can stop snoring in the next room or whatever that might happen. Or if I can just get my mind to be calm and quiet, and maybe the meditation will help me do that. And, of course, meditation can and will help the mind to quiet. But if we're doing that in order to somehow control our mind, we'll ultimately find that it doesn't quite work that way. There's this process of somehow trying to control experience, and the nature of it is that it cannot be controlled. But it needs to be understood. It needs to be understood. It's so tiring. It's so exhausting to be trying to control our experience when it's not something that we can really do. How many of us arrive on retreat and feel like, oh wow, this is really restful. You know what we got to do today? Did anyone find it a little like hard work? Tiring? Come to the end of the day and, whoa, you know, I'm ready to have some rest soon. Anyone feel like that? No, I can imagine. You know, if you describe to your friends what you did today, whoa, they made us sit on this cushion for almost 3/4 of an hour. And then we had to get up and walk back and forth, but very slowly. And then they said, sit back on the cushion, then stand around doing nothing for a little while and sit down again. And at the end of the day, I was so tired. Our friends, they won't believe us. They'll say, no, how can you get tired doing nothing? Yeah? And yet, what tires us so often, so much in a retreat, but also in our life, is the way in which we're putting pressure on to ourself, putting pressure onto our experience in a kind of, we could say, psychological, a psychic way, forcing, pushing, trying to get it to be other than as it is. I remember once discovering, finding myself, I was spending some weeks on retreat myself in a little cabin in the woods in France, in the foothills of the Pyrenees. And I went in summer when it should be sunny and warm and a lovely temperature. Again, I live in England where it's nice to go somewhere sunny for a change. You know, maybe from here you like to go somewhere where it rains. I don't know. But anyway, I went to France because it will be sunny. And for 3 weeks it had been raining. And I found myself one day standing outside the cabin going, and I realized I was trying to get it to stop raining by going, and it's kind of funny. But it's also kind of sad. It's like, oh, how deep, how strong that is within us, that attempt to try and get it to be so, as we wish it to be. And yet, we can't. To spend our life doing this is in many ways to be frustrated, exhausted, and unfulfilled. The Buddha once said of this, he said, fools seek to pursue experience. The wise seek to understand it. So that sense of pursuing experience, of trying to get our experience to be the way we want it, it's a foolish process because it doesn't really ever come to an end. Even when we get things to be the way we want them to be, they don't stay that way very long. Or they do, but we stop enjoying them so much. You know, if you ever had a large piece of chocolate to eat, and you start eating it, thinking, this is very nice, maybe I shouldn't talk about chocolate. Here you are on retreat, no chocolate, sorry. But, you know, you probably have the memory. We start eating some chocolate, it's very nice. If you keep eating it after a little while, it's not so nice. If you keep eating, it tastes actually really unpleasant. Have you ever done this? When I was younger, I did it a few times before I learned. Even something we enjoy becomes unenjoyable. So what other options do we have for our life? I'm not saying there isn't a place and an importance for cultivating and developing things that are wholesome and supportive that serve our lives, our well-being. in terms of experience, that we need things that provide, you know, for food, for shelter, for taking care of our responsibilities in the world. But there's something more to this life than just getting or getting rid of. There's something more to this. And on a retreat, we're really invited to begin to reflect, to consider, what are the deeper questions of our life? What is it that's really important for us? Because it's easy to postpone this, to think, first I will get things organized, sort things out, make sure I have all the practical things kind of nailed down. But there's no guarantee that will ever happen. There's no guarantee we'll ever come to that place where we can say, okay, now I'll take care of what's most important. When I was in my early 20s, I had the very difficult but also powerful, tragic and also precious experience of a dear friend of mine becoming ill and dying through a surgical misadventure that didn't have to happen. And it was a very sad, very grievous thing to happen. He was really the only close friend I'd had through my growing up. And his family had been a family for me when my own kind of fell apart. And at the time I was thinking, I had a job and I thought, I'll do this for a bit longer. I don't like it at all. I was working in a big, high-powered city law firm thinking, I don't like this. I don't like this, but I better do a few more years and make sure things are okay. And then I'll do what I'm really interested in. Then I'll find something that really touches me. And when my friend died, I realized that actually you cannot wait. I could not wait. I cannot expect that if I do something that isn't what's most important, that I will ever have the chance to do what is. And so there's an invitation in our life that says actually we have to live it now. We have to find and follow what's most important for us now. Here. That doesn't mean we have to leave the life that we have, but we need to look at it. We need to look at it carefully. So there's a poem. It's, I think, a popular poem on such retreats. Some of you may have heard it before, but I love it. By Mary Oliver, The Summer Day. She writes, "Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? I mean the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last, and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Doesn't everything die at last, and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? can we notice perhaps what happens if we turn towards that sense of the preciousness and the lack of guarantees for our life to continue? This is something that's recognized and that the Buddha spoke of as really helpful in turning us, in moving our hearts towards what is more important, to open to what is most important, to know we have not forever. We maybe have not even so long at all. Every day, people find out they have less time than they thought. Every day it happens to people like us. So we don't have to have an answer to these questions. What do you plan to do? I don't know, we might say. But what happens if we let ourselves feel into that sense? Do you recognize, do you hear that sense of this, the preciousness of this life? The preciousness of this life that isn't here for us to somehow make into something which fits our ideas of what we want or what we thought should be, but that's here for us to receive as a vehicle, as a doorway, as a pathway to travel more deeply into the fullness of our life and what it offers. So much of the time, of course, what we see, what is playing out, is not this. What we notice and what we're, I think, sometimes uncomfortably confronted with when we come on retreat, and it's not an accident, what we're confronted with is the way in which we're not so often really willing to live the life we have, to meet and to be fully in the experience that's here with what is arising right now. So much of the time is that sense of, no, I want something else, I want it something different, or it's going to be better somewhere else. And so much of what goes on to begin with when we engage in the retreat practice is we notice how much our mind wants to move away. We encounter boredom, pain, sleepiness, restlessness, anxiety, confusion, at times physical discomfort, emotional discomfort, you'd say psychic discomfort. The mind doesn't like the way things are. And we tend to pull away. You know, it's not an accident that it's, for most of us, not easy to sustain our attention, to connect in an ongoing way with the simplicity of what's happening. At some level, we don't always quite believe or trust that it offers us what we're really looking for. We somehow have been convinced, and it's not our fault that it's so, but we need to see if it is so, that we've somehow been convinced that something else is more important than this. This that is here, this that is now, this which is awake and alive and present and available right in this moment. Even if it's not something we find comfortable or flattering or easy or familiar. And so this movement of escaping, of moving away, of the mind, because we've said, no, I'll stay here. At least in our body, we stay here. And that's quite something, to stay on our seat, to stay in the space, to stay on the retreat, even if something in me says, I think I might prefer to go and leave the sitting. Or, you know, we might in our mind have started to plan leaving the retreat. We don't even notice it. There was once a student who came on a retreat with my wife, Catherine, in England, and he was on a retreat, and then she realized he wasn't there. And he came back a year later, and he said, you know, I was on that retreat and something was difficult and I was 40 miles away in my car before I realized I'd done it. Like the unconscious urge to go just happened. And it was only when he got to Plymouth, he wrote, oh my gosh, I left the retreat. So mostly we don't do this with our body, but the mind we see. And so again and again, we're asked to bring it back, to come back into this experience where we are. to see we can't escape our mind. As much as we try and escape our experience, we can't escape our mind. We see the way it tries to escape, the stories, the fantasies, the memories we start to get that become very interesting or very important, things we haven't thought about for years, people we haven't remembered for decades. Suddenly, oh, I must think about this person. I must figure out what I will do tomorrow or the next day. Maybe I should fold my clothes a little differently. It would be better. It's amazing what our mind comes up with. You know, have you noticed yourself going to the notice board to check the schedule to see if still the supper will be at this time or if it changed since the last time you looked? I find myself sometimes wanting to read the label on a tea bag. You know, it's really important information on that little square of paper to tell me something. And I'm looking at it going, oh, interesting. And then you realize, oh, no, it's somehow this urge to get away, to come back into. We cannot escape this mind. And we are asked again and again to open to it, to open to this experience. Because the way we find it somehow uncomfortable or unsatisfying is not to do with the experience itself, even when it's uncomfortable or scary. It's much more to do with our unwillingness or our difficulty in inhabiting it wholeheartedly. Our somehow reluctance to be fully here in the midst of this, whatever it might be. And so we are asked to turn towards, again and again, to turn to, again and again, to turn towards this experience. Thank you. To turn towards what's happening here. Whether it's comfortable, enjoyable, whether it's uncomfortable, difficult. If it is challenging, of course we need to bring a lot of kindness. We need to bring a lot of sensitivity and understanding for us that this is not easy. And that we have room, we can give ourselves permission to make some change of position if we need to. But to understand that this place, what's happening here, this is where we will discover what we're most deeply interested in. This is where we will discover the riches that our life has to offer that are not born of controlling or manipulating what is happening, but of understanding it and understanding it through entering into it completely, holding nothing back. To turn towards our life because we care for it deeply, because we care for ourselves. And what is possible for us is more than we can imagine or conceive with our minds. The Buddha spoke of this once. He said, I know of one single thing that leads more to happiness and well-being than a well-trained heart and mind. And I know of no single thing that leads more to suffering and distress than an untrained heart and mind. This process of training our hearts and mind, and the word the Buddha used, citta, I use heart-mind because it encompasses that whole field of what it is that we are, that we experience, that is affected by, that is touched by life and that responds to it, that includes both the cognitive and the emotional processes, the felt sense and the affect in response to what experience brings us. This whole field is something that can be trained, that can be developed, that begins in a state of entanglement, or that's how we discover it, and yet can disentangle, can become freed, liberated, opened out of that place of stuckness and contraction. And it's this that we're practicing here in a very simple and yet powerful process, to just notice what happens. when we disconnect from our experience, and to come back, to notice what happens when we close down to our experience, when we resist it, and to see if we can open. To notice what happens when we become uninterested in our experience, to see, can I be interested again? Each of these movements, of these processes, is simple in itself. That's not to say it isn't also challenging. But we can do this. It's possible for us. The attitude we deal with is really, really essential. It's so important to have a kindly and patient attitude to our own heart and mind. It's not that if we've allowed the mind to do whatever it will do, whatever it likes, to run, to react, to resist, for many, many years, we can suddenly say, okay, now stop doing it and be present. Stop thinking about all these things, stop reacting to all these things and just be here. No, it won't happen like that. It takes time. But as if we were training a puppy, a small dog that needs to know how to behave. And we want to train it to walk beside us. In English, we say to heel, to walk beside the back of your foot, essentially, the heel. Now, I don't know if you have a different expression here. But if you say to a puppy, follow me, heel, and it runs away, and every time it runs away, you grab it and say, bad dog, smack it, and then say, heel. The puppy will run. It wants to chase a butterfly. It wants to smell the flower. It wants to water a tree. Many things it will do. Every time if you say, bad, no, stupid, foolish. After a little while, the puppy thinks, this person's really angry and not very nice. I'm going to run away as soon as I can. Huh? Whereas if every time the puppy runs away, you say, oh, there you are. Oh, you're doing that. Oh, I'm not sure it's a good idea, but come over here. Come back over here. Over time, the puppy starts to think, oh, this person's quite friendly and kind. Maybe I'll hang out with them and see what happens. And in a very direct way, it's like that also for our minds. We create an environment of kindness, of care. And in that, we quite naturally find a willingness to inhabit what's here, to not struggle with the difficult so much, and to not struggle with our mind's tendency to move away. And then actually, over time, it quite naturally starts to settle more. You've probably noticed already there have been moments where there's just a sense of, ha, I'm here. Even just in one step, or one breath, or the sound of one thing we hear, and just notice, oh, okay, it's the bell ringing, or someone moving or coughing. Or we just notice it. That's simple. In the end, there are no obstacles. There are no distractions. There is nothing that is here that can be ultimately in our way. Except the idea that thinks there are such things. Equally, there is no experience which will finally fix, resolve, or do whatever it is we want our life to be made into. There is nothing that can do that for us, but there is also nothing that can stop that or that provides an absolute obstacle to this. The capacity that we have, that we are born with, is greater than we can imagine or know. And we access it simply in this willingness to turn towards, to begin again, to connect with this body, this breath, this sound, this feeling, whatever it is. We put our foot upon the ground, we feel the breeze against our cheek. Whatever it is, it's this. We notice we've been thinking very busily about what we will do next week. Okay, we notice that, and in the noticing, we're already here. In the noticing, we're already back. And we can begin again. We can begin again. to see what is happening, to begin to not contend with what is here, to not be asking that the lighthouse get out of our way, but to say, okay, how do I navigate here where there are islands and lighthouses and rocks? I must learn to pay careful attention, to see what is arising, to see the reactions that arise in us are not something we are bound to be carried away by. We can start to understand that urge to take hold of or to push away, to see it as a mechanism which is born out of our survival needs at a biological level and has its place, but isn't something that actually takes us to happiness and satisfaction. It's not there to provide fulfillment, and it doesn't. And probably we know this already, because that's why we're here. But perhaps we still also are learning this more deeply in our hearts and ourselves. And so the invitation here to allow our life to speak to us and to listen with deep care and respect, not just to the story, but to the rhythm that underlies it, to the, we could say, the nature of what it is that reveals it, to see our life with wisdom, with kindness. This is what transforms it. It is the very quality of presence, of care, of mindfulness, of sensitivity that we bring to the experience. This is what most profoundly determines the quality of the life that we have. And so we're asked to meet what's here unconditionally. And as we do so, this path and this life opens up. And it reveals what is here, which was always here. And this is something we are interested to understand. I finish with a poem by Ryo Kan. He says, the storm has ended. The clouds have passed away. And the sky is clear again. When your heart is pure, all things in your world are pure. Let go of this fleeting world. Abandon your struggle with yourself. And then the moon and the flowers will guide you along the way. So let's just sit quietly together for a few moments. So may we all, in our practice here together and in our lives, may we deepen in our capacity to enter this moment unconditionally, to meet the truth of our lives just as it is, just as they are, and just as we are, to discover for ourselves what lies at the heart of it all. For our own welfare and for the welfare of all beings.